Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing on my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Eddie and I, which was a part of the main competition at Venice Immersive. So this piece is a very much narrative-driven exploration of using hand tracking for communication and sign language. And so they're trying to tell the story of a deaf child who has this kind of imaginary friend monster character who ends up going on with him to this camping trip. And there's some things that happen that Eddie is the main character, even though it's called Eddie and I. You actually embody Eddie as the monster. And so it's this relationship between Eddie and this main character who's deaf. And so it's trying to teach you different aspects of sign language and, like, you know, four or five signs that you learn that you use at certain key turning points within the context of the story so that you progress the story by using the right sign language with your hands. And so overall, like, the context is about communication and the context of being a bit exiled from the culture and the experience of being deaf. But you also cultivate empathy and connection with this main character as you travel to a camping adventure and you become a friend. So the center of gravity of this piece is very much the water element in the story. It's starting with the story first. This is not a training application. It's not an educational application. It's very much a story. And there happens to be these other educational components a part of that. But it's very much framed through this lens of the narrative. The second center of gravity is the fire element, just in the sense that you are having these different key interactive components where you have to learn these signs and sign languages. And so the actions are very much informing the narrative. And so they're very tightly coupled in terms of the story as it unfolds. The third center of gravity is more of the embodied and environmental presence, where it's kind of an animated CGI type of experience, but you're also embodied as one of the main characters. You're embodied as Eddie, like this kind of monster, invisible friend type of character. And then there's also a bit of an educational quality to this piece. Like I said, it's not really an educational application, but the intent is to help teach and create other stories to be able to explore these different signs and sign language. And so it's communication through these embodied actions and, you know, cultivating the sense of empathy. Also, Maya got a whole lot of support through the production of this process and basically participated in all these different incubators, as well as like funding markets and then finishing funds, production bridges. And so she goes through all sorts of different festival circuits in order to support this, including like getting support from Meta themselves as kind of like a R&D research project to be able to have a very specific use case of the hand tracking that was being developed here. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Maya happened on Monday, September 1st, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So I'm Maya Shekel. I'm an XR creator. I own a studio called Moosh Studio, where we work on interactive content, if it's virtual reality, augmented reality, and really much more, actually. And we really try to emphasize on taking projects that blend storytelling, technology, and design to make meaningful projects with impact. So almost all our projects are those that have some kind of social impact on the real world.
Great. And maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
So I've been studying film my whole life, actually, from a very young age. And then in university, I went to do a bachelor's and master's degree in digital media, where we really emphasized it was kind of learning a lot of film together with how to develop quality content to new platforms, new technologies. When I started studying this, it was around 2016. So everyone was looking at me like I'm kind of crazy talking about the future of virtual reality. But I'm happy I stuck to it and really continued my journey. Then I started also teaching in university. So I teach in two big universities back home. And I really try to emphasize on teaching design thinking for producing content for these new technologies. One of my big projects that I did was called Tazoo in the past. It's the Tel Aviv Zoo. It used to be a zoo that was in the center of Tel Aviv, and we kind of reconstructed it in augmented reality, and we made it a very big event that connected the older community with the younger community, and it was partially a documentary, location-based app. The municipality kind of sponsored it, and that was kind of when I really started to understand that technology has a very big potential in bringing people outside, bringing them to learn about history, connecting them. And that's when I understood that this path is something that I want to continue going with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so maybe you could talk a bit about the origins of Eddie. Is it Eddie and I or Eddie and me?
The title is a bit problematic because actually we are playing Eddie. I'll explain about that in a few moments. But it's called Eddie and I. And Eddie and I is a 6DOF 22-minute virtual reality interactive experience. And we actually use hand tracking technology to teach sign language and expose the users to the world of the deaf and hard of hearing. We initially started working on it in the end of 2022, but it started years before through my niece. So she was born deaf. Today she has a cochlear implant, so she could speak and hear regularly. But when she takes it off, she's completely deaf. And really through her, I was exposed to this world. Today she's 12, and she started learning sign language on her free time. It's not the way she uses to communicate, but that's how I started exploring it and discovering a bit more. And for me, it was amazing to know that sign language is a very rich culture, based a lot on storytelling, but also very limited. It changes from country to country. If you want to learn it, it's usually through YouTube videos or private lessons, or really very limited, especially if it's not American Sign Language, which is a bit more popular. And that's when I kind of understood that I'd want to use the technology that I'm working on and that I know of and develop something that could help her. And this was years before end of 22, so hand tracking technology still wasn't so good. And I said, one day we'll get there. I promised to develop you an app that will help you. And fortunately, it took those few years where I understood that I'm less interested in making the next Duolingo for sign language, even though that could have been maybe more profitable, and more interested in making a more narrative experience that exposes users, make them pause for a moment with someone that's different, makes them overcome this communication challenge. And that's how Eddie and I actually started the idea behind it.
Yeah, and so where did you begin with this process of developing the story? Because you have the interactive components, you have the hand gesture and the detection, and then each of the different signs that you have, you're kind of using that to structure the story in some way, and you've got the quill and the animation, the world building. So just trying to get a sense of where you began.
So we actually did begin with the story. We were at a 5-day very, I'd say, intense story lab in Macquarie Film Foundation. They have Macquarie Media Fund and Hub. So it was a 5-day working with Nitai Dagan, which is our story lead or screenwriter. And we kind of tried to say, okay, we want to build an experience that connects between two people, but we also want the user to feel like the main character. So if the main character is the deaf boy, Ron, we also want the users to kind of feel what it is to feel a bit different, to feel a bit not knowing how to communicate with him as well, to put you kind of in the same situation. But this is actually also very important for me from the beginning, saying like, I'm not going to put the user in the deaf shoes. That's something that I feel uncomfortable with when I create VR. I don't believe that after a 20-minute experience, someone could say, okay, I know how it feels to be deaf, because you don't. I don't. And that's why for me, it was very clear that the main character who I need to communicate with will kind of simulate real life and be the deaf character. And I will be a hearing character, but also a character that doesn't necessarily know how to approach this. So we both start in kind of an unknown reality. And then we both come from a film background, Nitai and I, so we started looking at a lot of references, if it's E.T. or Monsters, Inc., or Where Do the Wild Things Grow, and really trying to understand how these relationships build in film. And we tried taking a lot of reference from those places. Wolves in the Walls was one of our big references as well. But I think the bigger mission was also understanding we're not writing only the character, only Ron's journey. We also need to think about the user, because it's not a virtual reality experience where you only have hands and you don't completely know who you are. We really had to build a very big backstory for Eddie. What are his goals? Why is he there? What is his mission? What is his motivation? Because we wanted this to be almost a seamless experience. We wanted you to kind of understand what you're doing because you understand the motivation behind it. So I think we kind of approached it more like a film and thinking of that perspective. And also, since we knew that one of the biggest barriers we're going to have is that it's a non-dialogue experience. We're not speaking to the character. We don't want to use narration. So we had a lot of steps to overcome and understand how in each stage we want to approach it. So if it was in the design, so it was clear to us that we want Ron, the main character, to be as most appealing as he can, someone that you could kind of almost instantly have some kind of empathy towards him. So we really, as you were saying, we have a lot of elements there. So for us, it started with the story. Then we went into a very deep process with the character design. So even though you don't see yourself, it was very important for us to really, as I said, give Eddie a background story, work on his design a lot, make him feel not too scary, but yes, a bit fluffy, and kind of work on that perspective. And then the quill design was actually something that started after we met Amaury Campion. And we discovered really that quill isn't just what I initially had in mind, that is a more, I'd say, sometimes it has a bit of a rough aesthetics, like not very detailed. So for me, I knew that I wanted, on one side, yes, to be very detailed, but on the other hand, to also feel a bit hand-drawn, because we were talking a lot about how Ron likes to draw. It's his biggest hobby, and also drawing being the most primitive communication language of kids and in general. So those, like, step by step, everything kind of started building up together.
Yeah, and maybe you could explain a little bit about some of the challenges of using hand tracking, which has been in evolution and changing, and it's been improving over time, but there's been some times where it's been pretty rough, even now I wouldn't say that it's like 100% being able to always detect. Like when I was going through the experience, so sometimes it was like having trouble with some of the gestures, you know, some were easier than others, I'd say, or either that or I was doing them wrong, one of the two. But yeah, I'm just curious to hear a little bit about what it was like to try to translate these ASL signs into the virtual reality programming in order to detect them and trigger the progression of the story.
So there's actually two elements. One is the hand tracking and the, I'd say, embodiment, or it's actually full body tracking. So also if you kind of bend or walk around, the whole body moves with you. So that was one element that, as you were saying, it kept evolving as we went, and it only went a good direction, I could say. Like it only went and became better. It was also a bit of a challenge because obviously the team working on the project are grown-ups, so we have some kind of height, but our target audience is also 10 and above. And only when we started user testing in school did we understand that that also has some kind of effect on, okay, but we want you to feel like a monster. We want you to feel tall. And Ron is your height if you're 10 years old. So how could we still play with that? So we tried doing all kind of cheats, but it's hard even to user test for us in the studio. So that was one challenge we had. But as you were saying, the bigger challenge was really understanding how we do this hand recognition system in the most effective way, because we were always thinking also about the future and, okay, if we want to do more words or if we want to do more languages, we have to think of a good enough system to keep adding these gestures. Thankfully, we had Meta on board with us from a very early stage, and we were working with the technology. I don't even know if to say it's a technology, but it's called Carl, which is something they've been developing for a while, which is a system that is pretty easy to record new gestures and kind of implement them in Unity. I'm saying easy, it took us almost 6 months to really start working on it together and implementing it, but we got amazing support from the team there. And the way we try doing it, and obviously as we go and user test more, we've been recording the gestures in the team. So I'm just going to also say we chose 6 gestures that you have in the experience. The first one is only to start the experience, so it's play. And then there's 5 gestures that you have to use along the experience. So what we did was we recorded them using Carl, but then it's a smart system, so it learns based on your gesture. So I would record it, our developer would record it, our producer would record it, and then we would also record what is a false gesture, like what you should not recognize. And then we user tested it a lot on the public to kind of understand where we need to expand, or we can make it a bit harder, the threshold, so people could try is one of the hardest words, obviously. I see everyone getting stuck there, so that's something that I know that we need to fix.
Is that with the two fists? Yeah. That was the one that was the hardest one that to detect.
Yeah. So there are solutions. You know, we could say, okay, after 15 seconds, if you don't get it right, we'll just keep the experience going. There's another solution where we even bring the threshold even lower, or we re-record what it's supposed to recognize. I mean, it's a bit of playing around with it, and obviously you have the hints. So maybe we understand, like, the hints have to be exactly what we recorded for it to recognize. So there's always, like, we keep going as we work. But I will say, like, let's say the words getting written after the gestures was something that for me as a director was very hard to implement, because I felt that it's translating, while in real life we don't have that translation with us all the time. But we just got a lot of feedback of people saying, okay, I imitate the words, but I don't know their meaning. And that for us was missing something even bigger. So that's kind of when we also decided to implement the meaning of the word you gesture.
Yeah, I had an experience of having the association of those 5 gestures and the words at the very beginning, but by the end experience, my recollection was that it wasn't shown again. So then I had to actually go back to the beginning and play it again just to be like, oh, okay, that's what that was. That was what that was. I think some of it was clear by the context about what the meaning was, but sometimes I would sort of miss something in the story because I was only shown what the words were once at the very beginning without any kind of repetition of that. I guess in other language learning processors, like the spaced repetition, where you kind of like go back and you are reminded after a certain part of forgetting. But yeah, I don't know if that's something that you've thought about or encountered, of people by the end of the experience have forgotten what each of the five meant.
It's a tricky kind of place to work in, because for me, this is kind of in the niche of edutainment, being an educational and entertainment app, but I was always afraid, I think, to make it too deductive or too much of a learning app. And I think it has its pros and cons in the experience, but I completely understand kind of what you're saying. And I think from our user test, what we saw was that children remember everything, which is pretty amazing. Like for most of the user tests for the grown-ups that we've done, I've been hearing that feedback as well. So that's kind of when we also decided to implement the word itself, because we said maybe that would help even more to remember the meanings of the words and kind of how to use them again. I think it's great feedback that I do think we could insert in all kind of ways.
So you're saying that this is a story-based experience, but also helping learn different signs. There's five signs. And so I'm just curious to hear where you take this next, if you're wrapped up with this story and then moving on to other projects, or if you want to continue to expand based upon developing all these infrastructure and processes to continue to tell more stories with more signs.
So that was definitely where we started from. In my mind, it was like, okay, this is the first episode where we learn five words, and then we kind of create a series continuing to learning more and more words and kind of making it like Toy Story 2, like having Eddie and Ron meet again when he's a bit more grown up and kind of doing this kind of content series. But also what was very interesting in the process of making the experience and speaking to more and more from the deaf and hard of hearing community and organizations, we were hearing more about how it's not a real need that more people know sign language. What is a real need for them is that children or anyone doesn't avoid speaking to someone with hearing aids or cochlear implants and doesn't know how to approach them. And usually that's the bigger gap, people not knowing how to communicate, so they just avoid, or they're not patient enough if they do, or they don't know the basic social emotional skills that are needed even. And for me, that made a big switch while working on the project. So I said, I know the focus is sign language and it's very important for like the first kind of overcoming this fear that we may have, but it's more about being patient with the other, pausing with the other, kind of accepting for 22 minutes, being face to face with someone that you may or may have not ever tried to communicate with. For me, the first time I had someone deaf in my class was in university. Obviously I had my niece with me my whole life. But when we user tested in schools and we did questionnaires, we understood that in the school we interviewed, 90% of the kids have never communicated with someone deaf. And then in general, in research, it says that over 70% of human haven't. So for me, it was more about, I think if I would do more episodes in the future, I would think of also focusing more on that message. And then I don't know if it would necessarily be learning more words or trying to approach it from different kind of Eddie the monster coming to meet other children in times of needs and making it that kind of approach. So that's kind of the dilemma I'm in right now of how we should develop that.
Yeah, the other nice thing is that you have these five signs, and the five signs in a lot of ways provide the architecture of the story that you're telling. So you have calm down, look, try, help, and friend, that with each of these signs then are having the structure of the story that are being played out. So maybe you could talk a bit about that structure and how you were matching up each of these signs to tell a story.
So as I said, in the beginning of the process, when Nitai and I just started kind of working, we said, okay, we're going to have 10 different signs. And the words were like branch, fire, like very like object oriented, because we started building the story and we knew it was camping. And then we did actually a short story lab also with NoGo Studio with Lawrence. And that's when we started zooming out and we said, okay, this is a story about friendship. It's about acceptance. It's about overcoming fear. So maybe we should emphasize on words that are more emotional and less, I'd say, like physical. And that's kind of when we started building the story first and then understanding what words could repeat themselves or what words you could overuse to kind of really make the users understand and feel like they're helping, I'd say. And I think this also is something for what you asked before. For me, one of the, if I would still keep working on Eddie and I, for me, the hardest thing when I see children playing is when they understand the words, they remember the words, and then they want to use, let's say, if you remember when Ron's afraid in the campsite, so I see the kids sign and calm down because they just signed at the scene before. And emotionally, and like idea-wise, it's amazing because they understood the word and they're trying to reuse it again and they're trying to make them calm down, and it's the right friendly thing to do. But technically, it's not the word we were planning for you to sign. So currently, if you sign the wrong word, then it just doesn't evolve, and then they have to learn which word we did mean. So ideally, it would be an experience where even if you sign the wrong word, then he would react in some kind of way, or the project still would evolve, still in a linear way, but maybe with a bit more,
It's like a kind of a realistically responding to whatever is provided.
Yeah, that would be obviously the dream, I'd say, to really respond to any kind of sign language you would do, also if it's the correct one in context and also if not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within bounds, of course, because you know, otherwise you're creating an entire language system.
Definitely, yeah. And also, like when I imagine it, it isn't like some kind of generative AI Ron commenting, like still same linear story, but just with a bit of animations to respond. Yeah.
Yeah, can you speak a little bit around collaborating with Studio Geppetto, with Quill, and you know, developing both the style of the worlds and the characters? And yeah, it's got a really nice look and feel from an animation perspective. And you have to bring all that into Unity, of course, in order to do all this other sophisticated gesture recognition and everything. So it's like exporting all that. So yeah, just love to hear a little bit more around your process of using Quill and collaborating with Studio Geppetto.
So yeah, so we actually met Amaury Campion from Studio Geppetto in New Images in 2023, where we participated and won the XR Development Prize, which was very surprising. And that's when we met him, and he kind of introduced us to Quill in a new way. Like, as I said before, I knew of Quill, and I saw a lot of projects made in Quill, but when he said, okay, I think this story really could match with Quill, I was like, yeah, but I've seen projects in Quill, and I want this, if we do Quill, I want it to be very detailed, very magical, and like I had a very clear vision of making it like almost a Pixar or a Disney movie but in VR, because for me I felt that at the time that there wasn't enough, I'd say, quality content that could be fitted for children as well. And part of the fear that parents may have of their children going inside VR is because they don't have their Disney library waiting there for them. Obviously kids 10 and above and etc. But the idea was, how could we make this very magical and safe place for young adults and children? So really that's kind of where me and Amaury started. He showed me his work and I loved it. So he was in charge, Studio Geppetto was in charge also of the 2D concept art. And once we really started working on that, we had an art director at our studio, Maor Sharvit, and together we really developed the sign language of the environments. And in parallel, we were actually working with No Ghost on the character design of the characters, which were made in Maya. So that was, again, something that we had a lot of discussions about, because we said, okay, if we're doing all the environments in Quill, should the characters also be done in Quill? And Amaury was smart enough to tell us animation in Quill is very difficult and you're dreaming of a big experience with a lot of animation, and Quill animation has a specific language that might not match this Pixar Disney style that you imagine. So we actually designed the characters in Maya and we animated them frame by frame in Maya. So it's not animated in Quill, the characters. The environments are 100% in Quill. And Amaury was amazing, and really, for the environments, it was really important for us that they look hand-drawn, but they also feel semi, I wouldn't say realistic, but semi, like, very detailed and something that isn't completely hand-drawn. And also, we were kind of always mixing elements from Ron's dream world and his real house in the environment. So that's something that you could see along the experience, if he has all of a sudden a lamp or books or drawers from his bedroom that are implemented inside the environments.
So in your artist video, you had a really nice view of the story structure, and it reminded me a lot of like the Joseph Campbell's like hero's journey. Just curious if you'd be willing to kind of explain this map that is appearing in the artist video that feels like it's kind of mapping out the story structure. So yeah, love if you could maybe elaborate on that.
Of course. So this is actually based on the Dan Harmon story structure. So as I was saying, Nitai really comes from the cinema field, and we kind of said if we want this to be a very emotional like kind of experience where you connect with the main character pretty easily, we need to think film, we need to think storytelling in film. And that's kind of when we started taking this circle of Dan Harmon and trying to think, okay, how does he work? How do different experiences we saw work? So yes, so it starts actually from Ron in his comfort zone, and he needs to overcome this fear that he has the next day, which is his camping trip. So there's you, need, go, search, find, take, return, and then I don't even remember what the last one is here. This was actually a board that we did really long ago when we just started in end of 2022, and we kind of redrew it here. But the idea is really, how do we make this emotional arc of Ron overcoming his fears? We tried thinking of what are children's fears, if it's fear of the dark, if it's fear of the unknown, if it's fear of scary owl eyes. So we really tried taking these fears and implementing it inside the experience. And then obviously after we become friends and after we start to search back to the way home and finding our friendship together, something is taken away from us. So that's actually the part where Eddie is eaten by a plant, which may or may have not been clear. And that's actually a place where we decided that Eddie, the user, won't have agency at all. So at that stage, you can't do anything. You can't sign. You can't help yourself out with interactive elements. People that we've been seeing are trying to like kind of open the plant's mouth or trying to touch the border of the plant. And that's where Ron actually overcomes his fear and his readiness to go on the camping trip and decides to save us, even though he had the opportunity to go back home through a portal that was in the scene. And that's kind of where he does his change. Yes. And then the return, obviously, returning back home and finishing this story cycle we had done.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I've seen the Dan Harmon, but haven't used it or as familiar, so very much appreciate you walking through that. So I guess the other thing that comes to mind is that there's a bit of a gameplay loop within this experience where you have like a cutscene narrative, and then you have some interactive parts, and then you have to sign, and then there's the next phase after that. So maybe you just describe designing this kind of looping nature of the story that is also trying to use different aspects of the VR interaction design as well.
So yeah, so as I said, it's a 22-minute experience. In my mind, it's built out of 10 scenes because that's how we approached it also in Unity. But the idea is that in every scene, you have a word to sign and an interactive element in the nature, because in the end, this experience, as I said before, it's also communicating verbal, like not verbal even, but finding a new way to communication if it's in sign language, but also to understand that we don't have to use a language to communicate. We could help, we could, as I said, build a fire together, we could play together with carnivorous plants. Like there's a lot of different ways of communication. And then it was important for us to really build the experience in a way that in every scene you have a word that you need to sign, an environment interaction, I call it. And then that kind of repeats itself for the 10 scenes you go through.
Mm-hmm. And also in your artist video, you do show a series of different development places that you took this piece and pitching it in different contexts. Maybe you could walk through some of the journey of, you know, process of getting funding and building up these collaborations, relationships. At some point you have Meta that's coming on board as well. And so, yeah, just love if you kind of recount that journey of building up the coalition of support and funding to build this.
I'd be happy to. So as I said, end of 2022, we got accepted to the Macquarie Film Fund Hub, where we actually started working on the development. We got funded by them for development and production, which the funding where I come from isn't that big. So we knew we'd have to keep trying to raise more. Luckily, we got into the development market at New Images. For me, it was the first time being exposed to this huge community and understanding that there is a future in what I love doing. And it was a very emotional kind of first festival to be in and understand this and understand that we work like how film works and that we could work with co-productions and we could work together. And for me, it was a really big turning point, I'd say. As I said, that's where I met Studio Geppetto. It's also where we won the first prize, which I do feel that did open a lot of doors, because people that in the end, we were there for 3 days, very intensive 3 days. We were back to back with meetings, but once we got the prize, I think people were a bit more interested or took it a bit more seriously. Luckily, straight after that, we also got the funding for Meta. And what was interesting that we got funded by a technical team in Meta, I'd say. It was the Reality Labs team working on the Presence platform that were looking for projects. They had a call for entry for projects that are using the Presence platform in original ways. We submitted. It was something I never thought we would receive. And besides the funding, as I said before, it was almost 3 years of technical support, like on demand. It was really amazing. Because it was engineers developing something and we were their case study in the end. We were giving them like very quick feedback and working on it together. So that was a really good point, I'd say, in the production. And then following New Images, we were invited to the Creators Market at Tribeca Film Festival. And that's, again, where we kept meeting people. We met Amory again. We started understanding, okay, this is going in a good direction. And then the last festival we attended in that kind of phase was right here in Venice Film Festival, where we were at the Financing Gap Market and we pitched the idea, and we had another full 3 day very intensive days, and that's where we actually met Reynard Films, which also became a few months later an official co-production between our three studios. And here is also where I met the film funds, and I already understood that they're very interested in the project. And I think the festivals and the markets were the best thing that I could wish for, and also the advice I give other creators, because you have to go and meet the people and you have to see that you're like-minded and your style and a lot more, so, and to build kind of a friendship. So yeah, so that was really the milestones in the journey. Then I think it was 2024, Unity for Humanity has every year around January a call for entry. We submitted, we got funded by them as well. And really being funded by film funds and tech teams was huge for me. When I got here, it was like, I don't know, like, I think the amount I told someone in one of the meetings that I'm looking for, they like laughed at my face, and I'm like, well, that's what I could allow myself to dream of. And then they were like, okay, just convert it to euros, and then it's realistic, like I said, in my currency. So I was like, okay, I can't even dream of that amount in euros. And in the end, that's what we got funded by. We got funded by CNC and Villa de Paris and FFF Bayern and Median Board and then Gesher Film Fund, and we really started collecting more funds, and that's what kind of led us also dream big and do, I think, a very like high quality animated movie, which is also not a movie, it's a full on experience, I'd say. Yeah,
having all the in the title cards and everything else, you've got a full row of lots of logos on the logo graveyard type of sheets of all the people that were involved. And yeah, it's also a great recounting of all the different production bridges and markets that are a part of people developing different projects. And so it seems like you kind of hit a lucky streak of hitting all of them and doing quite well of building up a coalition of folks that are interested in this project. I think it's also hitting on other aspects of accessibility in XR. And, you know, I've attended XR Access and had a chance to do an interview with folks from Gallaudet University. I'm not sure if you've come across Gallaudet or if they were interested in this project, or, you know, if you had any other communications with other researchers or folks that are in the XR field, but also in this intersection of accessibility and deaf and hard of hearing accessibility.
Yeah, so as I said, I also work at a university, so we are starting to understand what kind of research we would want to do around that. We're working with organizations, so we are implementing already in the community. Specifically festival-oriented disabilities I haven't yet delved into. We are working with Astrea, our distribution company, so I'm hoping together we could make a good distribution plan and put focus on that area as well, because it's not a regular like piece. It's a piece where we could really expand, and I hope change people's perspective, which also kind of brings me to the idea that for me it's really important to have an impact campaign around this project and bring it to educational systems and not just bring it as a one-time 20-minute experience, but also build around it some kind of toolkit or something for teachers that they could expand about and take to the directions that they're interested in. And that aspect is where I'm interested in doing maybe a research or delving into that a bit more and understanding how we could measure the impact and really use it and prove that virtual reality and experience like these have this effect on them.
Nice. And so what's next for Eddie and I then?
So for Eddie and I, we are working on a distribution plan, as I was saying. For me, the dream would be getting it to children's museums around the world and implementing it in educational systems. Obviously, it will go online, but I'm not putting all my hopes on the store, but really just getting to the right people. And for me, as I started saying about Motion, my studio, is that we really want to prove to ourselves and to the world kind of that these technologies could, in the end, also help us in real life. They don't only disconnect us from life, which virtual reality has that stigma, but how we could use it for real life needs and change. And specifically, I'm also planning to bring this project in Israel to Jewish and Arab schools and use it as a metaphor for meeting someone that's different from you. So I think it has more potential than even just kind of focusing on disabilities and bridging other gaps that unfortunately exist in this very hard world that we exist in. Yeah,
you mentioned that you work in a university. What kind of context are you working in? What kind of intersection with XR do you have?
So I'm actually teaching design thinking in XR. I studied at, I'm teaching in Tel Aviv University in the digital media program where I actually grew up in. So it belongs to the film and television school. And then in Reichman University, I'm teaching in the communication school. I actually did part of my master's in Sydney University in Australia. And that's kind of where I started understanding that it's really important to kind of keep giving this message to students, like how could we find a real need in life, but then not necessarily make a product around it, but make a interactive experience that also involves storytelling. Like, it's not black and white. So that's kind of what I preach for. And another obviously very strong preacher that I have is that if you're putting virtual reality headsets on people, you should find a good enough reason to do it, because that's kind of what I feel that also keeps these kind of things alive and brings the public to keep experiencing it.
What type of things do you want to experience in VR?
That's a great question. I think what's actually interesting here in Venice is that in each experience, I'm learning a bit more and understanding things that could be an interesting use of how to use things. For me, the experiences that I like are those that I feel like, that I feel connected to, and are projects that I kind of feel like, okay, this was amazing. It really used the potential that this technology has to give, and it's something that I could take with me. Some kind of, I wouldn't say skill, because I don't feel that I have to like receive anything from anything, but it could be to expose me to something new that I didn't know of, to criticize something. So those kind of experiences that stay with me longer are the things I like in virtual reality. Yeah.
Nice. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality and immersive storytelling might be, and what it might be able to enable?
That's also a great question. So as I was saying before, for me, the area of edutainment and children is really interesting, because I think that the more we move forward traditional ways of learning, if it's books or even mainly books, or in classrooms, so the younger generations are becoming a bit more, they need faster things, they need a bit more immersive, I feel, content. And I feel that these technologies have a huge potential to change minds, to teach, to expose them. And that's why this niche is really interesting. Children and virtual reality is very interesting to me, because I feel we have a lot of potential to keep them up to date, keep them interested if it's history, if it's cultural. So that's kind of one of the main reasons why this target audience is, in my eyes, very important. And that means that we also have to make very quality content and design experiences for them to be enough engaged and to bring them in. And kind of like what I was saying before, like for me when I was doing Eddie, I was like, dream wise I'd want to be the next Disney. I'd want quality content that I feel comfortable like telling a 10-year-old kid to put the headset on so he watches it. So that's kind of how I see the future. And
Great. Is there anything else that's left unsaid, or any final thoughts you have for the broader immersive community?
I think just really what's happening here is amazing and really mind-blowing here in Venice, to see the different direction that everyone's taking. And kind of there's always these talks about like, where is virtual reality going? Is it the future? Is it not the future? But I think that if we kind of stick to it and go through these hard times, I say, or not even hard times, but these times, like we could do like truly magic. And we're the ones taking advantage of the technology and not the technology over our content. So if we stick to that, I think there's a good future, I hope.
One follow-on question just on the title, because you did mention that it's a little confusing, just because when I heard Eddie and I was like, oh, well, the kids must be Eddie and I am the monster. But it's sort of switched where it's sort of like Eddie and Ron. You know, I'm just curious how you came up about that title.
Yeah, I think it's a confusion that most of the people have. It's something that I think we could have changed, but for me, like, well, it all started from Thomas Edison actually being deaf and making up the first kind of radio, and that was something interesting for me. So I knew that I want the monster to be called Eddie, as a short of Edison. And then, yeah, and then the title was Eddie and I, which I now understand as we went, became more and more confusing. But as I was saying before, when we're thinking of expanding the project, we're thinking of putting Eddie, the monster, as the main character. And then I think it's okay that he keeps on meeting people and that he's the main name of the title, kind of. But yeah, it's definitely very confusing because in the end, it's a fully embodied experience where you are Eddie and it says I. So yeah, that may change in the future.
Awesome. Well, Maya, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast. And I think there's a lot of really interesting innovations of hand tracking, detection, and just the way that you're having this intersection between this educational aspect, but also storytelling. And so this edutainment genre is really quite compelling. And I think there's a lot of potential use for as we move forward and many different contexts where that might be applicable. Also really curious to hear how kids were having much better memory and really taking to this way of learning. And so it reminds me of a lot of like Ready Player One, where you have all of this kind of really robust way that virtual reality is using in the context of education. And I think that's going to be true as it gets forward in the far future. If we have funding and everything else to like make that happen, there's not necessarily a lot of funding for educational experiences in VR just yet, but it does point to a future where I think it does actually make sense for a great use case for the technology that, yeah, just the affordances of the technology and how that could create a series of these different types of educational experiences for you to play once or come back to, and then by the end perhaps gain some more familiarity or fluency and learning languages. So, but yeah, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.